This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Kusu Chuang, and time to look at the top business headlines of the day. Qatar, of course, has been there, and it's both a business headline, a political one, involving huge amounts of international relations discussion, as well as looking at business implications there. So how do we start with this story? What's really developed in the Qatar Kingdom Saudi Arabia debacle?
Well, you will know the political dimensions more familiarly than I would, because, I mean, we understand that this little tiny Gulf nation has been sidelined by its neighbors for its supposed terrorist links with Iran and so on. Most famously, I think Saudi Arabia is leading this whole isolationist policy towards Qatar. But the reason why we're talking about it this morning is because in the light of that isolationist policies by its neighbors, there was some talk that it would be starting to dissolve its sovereign wealth fund. And this sovereign wealth fund has got its basically from its oil millions, right? So it's
oil and gas.
Oil and gas, yeah. It's huge natural gas reserves. It's built up this $335 billion global fund, which continues to hold stakes in companies like the oil giant Rosneft. It holds stakes in the U.S. gas company National Grid. It owns big stakes in Volkswagen, stuff like that, even football clubs. And then people were talking about it being, you know, in the process of dissolving some of these holdings. And out of the blue, it makes this unsolicited offer for 10% of American Airlines, which is completely a bolt from the blue, taking the whole airline by surprise. And it says it wants to do this by buying stakes in the open market.
You know what's really interesting is that Qatar has held its own against Saudi Arabia in this regional fight, right? And the fight is really between Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Iran, principally over hegemony
and
in Qatar's the region.
And Qatar's in the middle of this urinating contest,
yes,
right?
You know, and this, yes, and what I think Qatar has shown is that it can, based on that gas wealth, have an independent line. And what some analysts are saying, we interviewed people, on BFM about this, and you can check out our podcast, that basically the end game for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is to get Qatar to accept that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia sets the tone for the region, and it wants to make Qatar another Bahrain. But the thing about
so the Saudis are the big dogs in the area, right?
Absolutely.
And then you've got Mohammed Salman coming in.
That's right.
The new crown prince, and he's obviously a famous Qatar isolationist.
Yes. Well, he's isolation in the sense, he's got an aggressive policy, right? But what Qatar has already got on its side, not just the wealth, but also relations it has with Turkey. So if you know, just recently, Turkish troops landed in Qatar to do military exercises. And this, of course, is a show of strength. Qatar is saying, we have friends too who will help us fight off or fend off any attempt for more aggression. So it's a bit of a standoff. And the fact that Qatar continues business as usual, I think another sign of confidence.
Correct. Because out of the blue, and it took the CEO by surprise, actually, American Airlines, and he actually said that Doug Parker was the American Airlines CEO, who actually went public with this surprise and opposition to the Qatar incursion. But
is this a kind of a hostile takeover? No, it's 10%. It's not hostile.
10% is not big, but that's what Qatar does. It takes strategic but substantial stakes in foreign companies. And American Airlines is a big player in the North American airspace. So, but according to regulatory requirements, there is no there's a prohibition from anyone, a foreign company, owning more than 4.75% of the airline unless they get board approval and there's a written request. But no such request has come yet. So this is something that we are watching with a close eye.
Does American Airlines need this infusion of cash? Will it be good for the company? And if they're arguing against it, are they arguing purely on the basis of sovereignty? Because that often happens too, right?
But any discussion about fresh funds always has got to come in terms of its strategic value to the business. I mean, Qatar might have stuff with other airlines like LATAM Airlines in Chile, but these are all investments. They don't necessarily put people on the board to run the business like a Berkshire Hathaway might. You know what I mean?
Okay, so Qatar, it has its own airlines, a very successful Qatar Airlines.
Yeah.
And they're responding to this crisis too in all kinds of
interesting, creative ways. So also in our crosshairs, I love saying the word, because
in
you know crosshairs,
I say crosshairs. Yes.
Bad habits, Gerard. Tesla also in the news, because they have the news flow from them is that they're trying to work with Shanghai to explore output in China. And I think there's this discussion about how Tesla might be producing vehicles in China, the world's biggest car market in the world. I think they overtook America some years ago in terms of sheer sales numbers. I think something like 15, 20 million cars sold a year in China.
Everybody so electric cars, basically.
Yeah, Tesla are electric cars, but generally the car market in China is flying.
See, the thing about the environmental dimension to this, the electric car side to it, is the question of whether China's providing for or allowing the provision of that ecosystem that's necessary for electric cars, right? Basically, places where you can go and get your car charged. I think that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is China really is pushing the environmental agenda very strongly.
Which they never really used to, remember? They were quite famous critics and opponents of climate parity, but now things have changed, and I think now America, bizarrely, the titles have turned because
China is the big champion of free trade,
and America is going the other direction. It's really weird how.
Yeah, but it's important to note that so there all these kind of policies, I think, driven at various levels in China, at the local, you know, and then of course the federal or national level on this. And if you are interested in a book, Chuang, I've read on China.
Tell me all these titles. I don't have any time to read them, Sean.
I'll tweet it out and tag you to it so you'll remember it. Jonathan Watts, When a Billion Chinese Jump, a brilliantly balanced...
Jonathan Watts, did you say?
Watts. W-A-T-T-S. And he is he's a British journalist, lived in China for a long time, wrote for many newspapers like The Guardian, Telegraph and such, and puts together a very even-handed portrait of China and its struggles over the environment, like in terms of on so many different levels, from conservation to dealing with environmental pollution to innovation that's happening in some cities in China and such. So, you know, China is a really complex field of play when it comes to how human beings are dealing with not just climate change on a global scale, but also environmental issues at a local level.
But where electric vehicles are concerned, I just want to point out that Tesla's biggest overseas market until recently was Norway, and the Norwegian government has given this huge and amazing generous incentives for electric vehicles, which is why it's the biggest market for Tesla. But then the UK also followed suit with its own generous EV policies, and China with its clean aspirations, they want to take the lead in electric vehicles in Asia. So I wouldn't be surprised if this whole Tesla investment in Chinese production facilities in Shanghai is not, you know, not unlinked to this whole move.
You know, also what's interesting to note is, there are, because people celebrating China's rise, there are also people, not naysayers, but people have cast a critical eye on what's happening in China. And coming up on our grill, in a couple of weeks, is a discussion with the author of a book, China's Crony Capitalism, Professor Pei Minzin. And it's a fascinating book about the changing nature of corruption in China and how it might derail these great aspirations that both Xi Jinping and the Communist Party have for the country.
So I presume that's your grill, but in a nutshell, what does it mean? How does corruption evolve and, you know, become level two?
Well, what happened after the Tiananmen massacre was that China changed its policy over ownership of a lot of state enterprises. And so, but it didn't create a strong enough
privatization thing.
Absolutely. But
a la Russia, a la oligarchs.
That's right. So there you have it.
They shifted from SOEs to individuals who were closely linked to government anyway.
That's right. So they captured state assets because of the poor legislative framework that actually left a lot of state assets in limbo. So there are a lot of state assets, state-owned enterprises that are on the books, owned by the Chinese, not even privatized yet, Chuang, but in fact owned, whose wealth is being siphoned off by well-placed individuals. And so this is the kind of like deep corruption that's happening in China, according to Professor Pei. And that's something we're going to be having on the Breakfast Grill shortly. Not today, but in
a couple of weeks.
In a couple of weeks. So look out for that. We'll be back with more business news after this at BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Kusu Chuang. And the morning run continues with the top business headlines of the day. We take a look at 1MDB and also its implications for our ratings, credit ratings. And also, just to remind us, there's a huge discussion out there about this Royal Commission of Inquiry into Forex losses from over three decades ago. Today's Sina Harian front page has Datin Sri Wan Aziza and the headline, Dissa RCI Siasat 1MDB. She's calling for a Royal Commission of Inquiry into 1MDB. And so it's interesting, within the kind of Malay-speaking public, there's also this keen awareness of the, in some ways, anomalous focus on forex losses from three decades ago, without the an equal attention paying to contemporary problems. And 1MDB, of course, is a source of many of those.
Of course, quite staggering that we should call for an RCI on something which happened 30 plus years ago, but not RCI on 1MDB, which is being investigated in seven other sovereign nations.
In jurisdictions,
but, jurisdictions.
Okay,
but,
coming,
moving along.
Moving along. Standard & Poor's global rating suggests that political challenges in Malaysia pose potential risks to our sovereign ratings over the near to medium term, and this includes 1MDB.
Not unconnected with the previous item from Sina
Harian. And also coupled with the upcoming general elections, G14.
Yeah, so the whole issue now, Malaysia's long-term foreign currency sovereign credit rating stands at A-, and that's obviously investment grade, but that might come under threat because if Malaysia doesn't get its fiscal house in order, and I think we've got this avowed intention to be to achieve parity, fiscal parity by 2020, which S&P, coincidentally, saying that that's an ambitious plan because of where oil prices are, where tax collections are. And I guess that's one of the manifestations of why Malaysia's introduced this tourism tax, where it's, you know, stepped up collection efforts and more aggressively by the inland revenue so that we can balance the book. So the greater good theory obviously comes into play. But
what is Standard & Poor's saying about the potential for this downgrade? What is it that we have to be looking at in order to get a sense of whether this is going to come to fruition, is going to be realized, you know, like in, for instance, public finances or contingent
liabilities?
Well,
quite simply, without trying to disguise it with too many financial terms, it's just basically Malaysia's got to spend less and make more. It's got to spend less money and make more money, right?
So how's
it's as simple as that.
So how's the upcoming general elections at all part of the mix?
It depends on how it's funded, right? Because obviously the last elections we had, there was huge, you know, stories of huge, you know, amounts of money being raised and having to be spent on appeasing the masses in terms of giveaways and handouts. I mean, in overt terms at least, you've got things like the Brem handout, which cost a couple of $1 billion or ringgit each time. That's got to be financed one way or another.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Brem, and I know there's the attempts to frame it as a political tool, right? It's basically about trying to get political support or mobilizing political capital through a Brem handout. But we had a discussion here a couple of months ago now on the Breakfast Grill with an economist and somebody from the World Bank. And the idea of cash handouts has become quite an accepted way.
It is.
Right?
I mean,
of relieving pressures on the population. In fact, yesterday,
cost pressures, yeah.
Yeah, yesterday I spoke to Professor Guy Standing from SOAS about the universal basic income. Again, but the difference is this, right? When you talk to pollsters like Merdeka Center about the actual effect of such a handout, he's saying the bump is small and it doesn't last. I mean, that's the last I heard of the assessment of something like BRIM. So politically, in fact, that there might not be as much as we imagine there is in the BRIM
handout for
politics.
It's like getting a bunch of angpaos at Chinese New Year. You blow it all within a couple of weeks or on, you know, oranges or whatever. And then the thing is, you want to have a bump in income, which is, you know, recurring and sustainable. You don't have a bump once a year and then you blow your bullets and that's it. But it's an accepted notion that, you know, most other developed economies, like in Australia, you get cash handouts all the time. And umbrella cash, I mean, it's been supported by economists. We spoke to people like Steve Keen, he, the contrarian economist, he's in support of helicopter cash. And it's necessary when times are tough and you know, costs are rising and incomes are moribund. But
I would actually would encourage everybody to listen to download that podcast on
with Steve Keen.
Guy Standing on the universal basic income.
Okay, so you support yours, I support my Steve King. Go and watch it. Go and listen to it, right?
Okay.
But just going back to...
Is there a timeline on the Standard & Poor's downgrade? Is a potential downgrade?
You see, the thing is, in the... you know, 10 years ago, the big three ratings agencies, the Moody's, S&P's, and the Fitch's, they were quite famously slow to off the mark in terms of downgrading the credit ratings for the big nations in the global financial crisis. So this time around, I think whether or not they're trying to be more proactive, they've just downgraded Australian banks because of the high household debt, because of its exposure to the property market, right? In Australia, household debt as a percentage of GDP is 123%. Massive, right? Everybody that is leveraged to their eyeballs in debt, okay? Malaysia, which we make a big deal out of it, we're 88.4%. So we're still some ways off Australia. So in Australia, they downgraded, Moody's downgraded four Aussie banks. It just goes to show that nowadays ratings agencies, if they say they're going to put you on ratings watch and they're going to putting you under the magnifying glass, they might just pull the trigger. You never know.
Okay, so the consequence of a downgrade would mean it's more expensive.
Higher borrowing costs.
For banks, right?
Yeah, so because what?
They will pass off to consumers, perhaps in higher interest rates on bank loans and stuff.
So if I lend you money and I know that you're an ironclad borrower and you're going to pay me back every month on time, and then you start, maybe that works for a couple of years, but after a couple of years, you start to default and you say, hey, Chong, I pay you next week, can or not? Then, you know, your rating, your credit rating in my eyes, you know, decreases a couple of months.
Yeah, I'm not going to have to one.
And then I'm going to say, well, you know, Sharad, instead of just pay me 3% interest a year because you're fantastic now, I'm going to ask you to pay me back 4% a year because you're not so fantastic anymore. And that's what it means.
Okay. Also in the news, one MDB, Luxembourg watchdogs, have fined a local arm of Swiss private bank, Edmond de Rothschild, nearly 9 million euros. That's about 10 million USD, which at this point is about 42 million
so
ringgit.
Other countries, including this one, Switzerland, the jig is up for the perps, but not in Malaysia, where you know everything is still hunky dory.
So, do we have details on what was the error in terms of this private bank, the Swiss private bank?
Well, it's basically money laundering and illegal fund flows, right? Because obviously, in that part of the world, they take governance quite seriously. So the Luxembourg watchdogs have fined Rothschild. And this is just a small private bank, mind you. The numbers are small, 9 million euros.
And I know why these countries do it, like Singapore. They're trying to
protect. They've got reputation stop hold.
Absolutely. Right? So they're protecting the integrity of their financial system.
Same as in America, same as in Singapore.
And pulling Falcon. Up, Aaron, you know, when people are lax with the rules, they pull them up and they pull them up in a very decisive.
And they find them.
And they wrap them on the knuckles because they are concerned about the integrity of the
That's
system.
Right?
We should be too. Okay, DRB HICOM says it's buying over part of the redeemable convertible cumulative preference shares. My goodness, that was a mouthful. RCCPS of Proton, that Proton issued to a government-owned company.
Yeah, so this is obviously just a legacy transaction from the capital raising that Proton needed pre-Gili infusion, which, by the way, DRB HICOM is having a press conference this morning, having suspended its shares yesterday and today to facilitate this announcement. It's going to be a finalization of their deal with Geely of China. I think, according to the heads of agreement some weeks ago, they were supposed to sell 49.9% to Geely and 51% of Lotus to the Chinese consortium. And DRB would maintain 51% of Proton and 49% of Lotus. So this whole thing is, you know, related to the fact that Proton now has this new dawn waiting for it in the Chinese auto market, you know, dibs into ASEAN with this new SUV that Geely is giving them with the BoYu platform. So hopefully all this kind of just works out for the Malaysian car maker.
Okay, so this just means that plan is now on track. It is reaching those markers on its way to realization.
Pending the announcement this morning from the DRB management crew, that's where it stands as we know it. So all this, you know, this bond buying, this return of this reimbursement of 1.1 billion for R&D undertaken by Proton. By the way, most car makers in Malaysia get R&D grants by the Malaysian government. So Proton is no different, okay? And we, you know, so it's just to take the car industry forward.
So is this, I mean, your assessment, this is a good thing?
Which under the deal with China's
the deal with Geely, yeah.
Absolutely. It's a lifesaver. That's a white knight. You know, you can imagine the Geely Corporation riding on this white horse with, you know, spears, you know, saving Proton
from the clutches.
What was
also in the news yesterday was debacle for Dalian Wonder. You read that? I mean, there was a lot of kind of chatter around this as being tied to Dalian Wonder's relationship to Malaysia. That this was not a good thing for Dalian Wonder, and it was affected its shares. I mean, do you have any details on that?
Well, no. I mean, just this whole veil of suspicion and, you know, the way China's privatization. We talked about this a few minutes ago, Sharad. It's not the ownership is just passed to individuals, but the problems remain the same.
Okay. Also in our crosshairs, SP Satya. It's a takeover, INP Group, for 3.65 billion ringgit. Very quickly, we can.
Yeah, so INP has 4,300 acres in Johor, Selangor, and KL. SP City has 5,200 acres. And it just goes to show, in Malaysia, to be a player in the property development scheme, either you're massive township developers with thousands and thousands of acres of land bank, or you're small boutique players. So obviously, Satya is maintaining its position as a big dog.
Okay, coming up after the bulletin, we have, of course, the Breakfast Grill, and Tan Chung Han speaks to Alvin Chua, President of the Federation of Malaysian Freight Forwarders. And that's going to be a big discussion, taking you from 8 to 8.30. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.